couple of teams getting a couple of dust ups last night here in the city. Leafs and Raps. I want to know what the policy is on getting your headband snatched by another man. Like, we know that you can't have a chain snatching, right? We learned this, Aqib Talib. It's like, yeah, cannot have that. Michael Crabtree, never going to live it down. Absolutely not. Did he get it twice? I can't remember. No. I think they fought twice, but he got the chain only the one time. But probably no shame in letting it happen when the guy taking it from you is over 7 feet tall. If Brook Lopez takes, an article of clothing from you, I think that you're probably okay. Pretty bummed out by that Raptors loss, by the way. A little bit of a sprinkle on them. The one time I didn't want the tank, of course, they end up doing a little bit of the tank. No Giannis, no Chris Middleton. Still can't get it done. It's hard to even say Chris Middleton because they haven't had him basically all season. But yeah, Raptors again, find another way to lose. And I'm going to start with them because I'm going to pivot to the Leafs before I do Christopher Stieg here in a couple of minutes. Rumor mill picked up pretty heavily in the last 48 hours for the Raps. And I don't know if this is going to be kind of... I don't know how much more we're going to get. It's going to be pretty fascinating to see what exactly happens. But you're starting to see a pattern emerge within or from all the insiders. Right? It's like, it's the same thing, basically worded a little bit differently from a couple of different guys. Essentially that they're absolutely moving Gary Trent Jr. Like, that is happening now. If you had some ideas about him being younger, a shooter, blah, 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 the money that he's looking for this offseason is absolutely massive. Guy, I guess, deserves it. He's a bit of a gamble, I think, at that. I think that his defense is definitely overrated because of the steals. Like, when I see other people mentioning that he's a 3-and-D guy, I'm like, he's definitely a 3 guy. It sucks because he's definitely someone that the Raptors identified, obviously tried to bring in here through the Norm Powell deal. A big part of it was supposed to be his age. If you look at a lot of the reasons why they went out and got Gary Trent, it shouldn't have just been, hey, you're kicking the can down the line for a couple of seasons, because ultimately they ended up getting him for what was the end of a pandemic season, which ultimately there was a lot of smoke that he wasn't thrilled about being a Raptor right away. He has the off season where Masai hands him just a 2-year extension, because the third player option I don't think was ever going to be realistic for a guy like that. And it was during a window where the Raptors were going to have to, like, a lot of this was expected. I don't know how many people thought the Raptors were going to be contenders in the next 2 seasons. I think things worked out really well for Gary Trent. It kind of remains to be seen how well it worked out for the Raptors, depending on what type of a price they get back. You would assume that there's going to be a pretty robust market for Gary Trent Jr., but, like, just looking at some of these mock trades and even just factoring in that Trent does have his contract come up at the end of the year, I think that, and the big dollars that he's looking for in the offseason, it's going to take a pretty serious commit from another franchise to get an overwhelming price or something that really makes you feel like, oh, okay, so this is the way that they're going to pivot next year. This is really going to help with the pivot or really help them build around the guys that they have. The more interesting guy remains Fred VanVleet, and Shams spoke about him yesterday. He was doing some shows. He wrote a piece. I thought it was actually kind of buried and lost that Shams also reported that the Raptors are looking at Jakob Poeltl. I went, oh, it's interesting. It would be pretty funny to see the Raptors move Gary Trent and then flip the assets they get for him in order to get in on a Jakob Poeltl trade and just bring that team back. Team with less shooting, but more center. The Poeltl thing's kind of interesting because he was so close with Pascal Siakam, if you remember. Like, those guys, yakking skills, two best buddies, the front court, the defense. Of course the Raptors need a center. Of course it's going to be a long time before... It's going to be a long time before we see what Christian Coloco can actually do, whether or not he's a serious player. There are some flashes here or there every single night, you know. But it hasn't been a great season for him, and rightfully so. He was a second-round pick, and no one was really supposed to be leaning on him to play. But, yeah, Jakob Poeltl's 27 years old, okay? So if you're bringing him in, I think it's a pretty clear-cut scenario that the Raptors are keeping Fred VanVleet, they're keeping Pascal Siakam, and they're going with the merge the timelines plan. And the more I'm looking at this, the more it kind of feels that way. The big thing with VanVleet, though, now, is what Shams reported yesterday, that the Raptors are going to have to pay up, that they will not be getting some kind of suppressed VanVleet market. This is a guy who has told us every single day of his career as a Raptor who he is, which is a competitor, a tough guy, a big game player, a winner, but also someone who knows about his finances and is going to take care of his finances. I think that it was Marshawn Lynch that said, "Take care of your chicken." It's like that's Fred VanVleet. Like, he's not screwing around with the money. And so if there are other suitors like the Suns, there are other suitors like the Magic, which are being reported by Shams Charania today, then yeah, they're going to push that price up. A team like the Magic that wants to take a step, they're not going to screw around with that. A team like the Suns, who's going to be moving off of Chris Paul, going to see the end of his career happening, they can't mess around with Devin Booker. They need to make sure that he has a co-captain in that backcourt as long as he's there. They got to try to keep him happy. They got to be aggressive. New ownership group coming in there, they're going to continue to want to win. They're going to want to continue to fill those luxury boxes, and they are definitely going to want to have playoff revenue. So the idea of like the Raptors grabbing Fred VanVleet on less than $114 million is feeling less and less likely. I still can't believe that they would end up keeping him and then wanting to pay him that money based on what has happened this season. It's just really hard to envision like what happens next year that really turns this thing around, especially when you enter it without Gary Trent Jr. from the very beginning and some pieces from his trade, maybe another mid-level exception, maybe a couple of draft picks. And yeah, the Raptors have this big reputation of being this awesome draft pick franchise because they have nailed some picks. But yeah, recently, that's not really been the case. And Barnes doesn't count because he was he counts and he doesn't. It's like, he counts in the sense of we were all idiots thinking that he was 100% going to go behind Jalen Suggs. But yeah, you still picked in the high lottery in a good draft year for a guy that we knew had an NBA-ready body and was going to contribute right away. Like, it's harder to miss in those spots than some of the later ones that it looks like the Raptors would be picking in right now. But yeah, how does that really work? And then what, Fred? You're trying to compete a year later from then? Like, you're hoping that Barnes takes that step, and then what, Fred's 31 years old and he's making that big money anyway? It's not going to be the worst thing if the Raptors end up re-signing him, but reading about those other teams that would be interested in his services was a reminder that the fantasy land of him returning on the cheap and them getting some kind of a discount and then the cap shooting up and the Raptors being able to work around that, I think that that's a little bit of... Yeah, that's a little bit of a reach for a lot of people. So the other physical team last night, the Leafs. Don't mess with the Leafs, all right? You mess with the Leafs, you have to fight Michael Bunting and Zach Aston-Reese, all right? You got to pay the piper. Those lads are coming. I love that, though. I know Versteeg's on the line, so I'll just jump in right with him. Chris Versteeg, two-time Stanley Cup champion, inventor of the Clever app. You just got back from Detroit, just like bringing your team down there, big deal. What did you think of the physical stuff last night? Because I really thought that that's what sparked the game. I thought that's what turned it around. And maybe that's just me wanting to live in a fantasy land where that stuff matters as much as it used to. But like, I absolutely loved it. It was just a real refreshing change of pace for this team.
Well, let's talk about how you left me on the line for 3 minutes talking Raptors and had me panicking that
that's
I was going to have to come
fault.
On here
that's the
and talk
fault.
About the NBA draft. I was not ready for that, but now you've turned it back around.
Do you want to share some thoughts on the Raps? Like, do you have any thought?
Sign Fred. That's it. That's all I got. Yeah. Give Fred his money. Give Fred his due.
Okay. Yeah.
Hey, what did we say, though? What was it about? A month and a half ago, 2 months ago, when Leafland was boiling and they had to beat the Boston Bruins and it was going down, they needed players in the lineup that just brought consistency. They didn't need guys that are groundbreakers. They didn't need guys, more skilled guys. They needed guys that you could put in the depth piece of your lineup that were going to be consistent and they're going to contribute and basically kill the clock. I think that's the word that I used. And you have guys like Zach Aston-Reese and McCann and these guys deeper in the lineup that are technically clock killers, and they're playing physical, and they're sticking up for their teammates, but they're giving you consistency, can't even say that word anymore, throughout the lineup. And that's all you want from those guys, right? You just want them to go out there, do their job, get through that shift without getting scored against, maybe hit some guys, bang some bodies, you know, create some turnovers, create a bit of fear on a forecheck, get their D thinking different things rather than, oh, we're just going to try to score off the rush on each and every line. And that's what these guys have been doing. And yeah, they've been playing physical.
I just love that Matthews eats a couple of cross checks and Michael Bunting jumps right in there, flips the gloves off, grabs a body, drags him down, and tries to fight. That after Gudas has a couple of dirty plays, Zach Aston-Reese, who I don't think has even, you know, fake attempted a fight this season, immediately chucks the mitts off and forces Gudas to turtle. Like,
Gudas is a liability on ice. Like, he is a complete liability. Every time he's on, someone's going to get hurt. Guy should be out of the league. But keep going.
Well, I mean, that was pretty embarrassing that he turtled after he did that.
Yeah.
Like, he's running that Pierre Engvall of all people, and he's, like, taking dangerous shots where even his goalie is probably in vulnerable positions. I wondered how his coach would feel about the one hit into the net. But then to turtle like that, I don't know. I don't know how to feel about that one. He's trying to take a penalty, and
he's trying to
disgusting.
Assess for his team, but he's a tough guy, right? Like, he's tough, but he's consistently out there. He low blowed the guy on the one kind of like half hip check, which should be clipping, right? They've talked about putting that into the league. That was a dirty, dirty shot. He hits Riley, and you know, Riley kind of opened himself up for that, but you know, Gudas goes in pretty recklessly into that situation on that goal. I thought Riley was going to be plastered against the wall, but Gudas did lighten up a bit, which never really happens. And there's just consistently, you know, throughout the game, he's just leading with dangerous hits. But, you know, the guys were sticking up. You said Zach Aston-Reese, he comes in and he's willing to go with Gudas. Gudas lays down and turtles, like you said. But it's something that the Leafs need, right? You have Simmons in the lineup. You know what you're going to get from him. Zach Aston-Reese, maybe he's not going to always drop the gloves, but you know he's going to come to their defense. And that's what you need. You just need the willingness to stick up for each other. And actually in the third period, when Matthews is getting all those cross checks laid on him in the corner, he turned around and gave a shot. I was actually happy to see that fire, because when he's giving shots back to guys who are taking liberties on him, I think that gets the team going. It got him into the game. And then the Leafs really take over from an emotional standpoint.
And if Austin Matthews had a little bit more nastiness to him, he'd just be the perfect player. Like, it's just, he's right there. He's on the precipice of it. It's just, you wish so badly that I don't ever really want to see him fight, but you're right. I do want to see him where he just gives the cross check back and doesn't stand there doing the smiling thing. And hey, to his credit, he actually grabbed the body. And like, when the scrum happened, he didn't just completely go off to the side. He grabbed somebody. I liked seeing that from him. But then he scores right after, right? And he's Austin Matthews. So, like, it shouldn't be, like, a freakish thing that he ends up scoring. But they turn the game around. And the point I was making last night on Leafs Talk, man, is obviously they're not a team that people fear when it comes to, oh, you're going to have to answer the bell for this. And I don't even really know how much the NHL is like that anymore anyway. Like, I don't think that guys are really fearing, like, Semenko, right? Where he's like, I'm going to beat you until
you're
black.
There's none of that anymore. Yeah, exactly.
Like, that's done, right? Like, we mythologize that stuff. We still want a little bit of that in there, but it's just, that's not a thing. But I especially like that they did that, like Aston-Reese and Bunting, because I think you can fake it a little bit more in the NHL today. And to me, it's not about, like, intimidating the other team. It's about giving confidence to the rest of your teammates that people have your back. And of course, like, those guys are friends and they believe that to a certain degree, but like, it's got to feel a little different when someone does that, right? When they take a little bit more risk for you, because just in a regular walk, like everybody's regular life, that kind of thing happens and it makes you feel a little bit taller. It makes you feel a little bit more connected to the other person. And so how does that feel? Like, how does that feel? Because I'm guessing that you probably even remember different times where guys came to your aid and it really meant something to you as a player.
Yeah, again, like in those days when someone came to their aid, they really put themselves at risk. It is a little bit different now, but there's still that psychological piece that, hey, I got nailed here. A guy's coming to my defense. He's willing to come in and fight for me rather than just skate by and go off. So I think guys are like, it doesn't really matter. But when you show that solidarity, it does bleed throughout the team, whether they're going to fight or not. But just coming to your aid and coming to your defense. I don't always like, after a big hit, guys coming in to fight. But I do like guys coming in to acknowledge, hey, you took a liberty on my buddy. You know, I'm right here to step up for him, right? They don't always have to fight, but I do love that because it does bleed throughout the team and it does feel good. I mean, there's numerous times in my past, you know, Jonathan Toews got his head taken off by Willie Mitchell. Center ice, it's been shown everywhere. He come out of the box. Willie Mitchell, Brower gave him kind of a bit of a suey pass. No love to Brower on this right now. And then all of a sudden, you know, Willie Mitchell gets up and I got to fight Willie Mitchell, right? Like, and he's going to murder me. He's 8 inches taller than me. But, like, that type of thing, Taser comes right back after. He's like, hey, thanks for standing in there for me. You know, you've literally put your life on the line, actual life on the line, because Willie could have pounded me to a pulp. He took it light on me. But that's what it does. It gets to the rest of your team, and these are the guys you need to stand in for.
I like that you're thanking him years later.
Yeah, thank you, Willie. Mitchell. If you're listening, thank you.
Yeah, you're still able to have a good enough brain to be able to invent the Clever app and do all the super leagues and run all these different things. By the way, you went to Detroit and you texted me a picture of your seats. It was like, really nice. I have more pull than you in Detroit. Like, there's no way I'd sit that high. That was
when I
like,
was
did
a
you
kid,
know
I was
you
in
could
the
sit
dog
that
house?
High? Had you ever done that?
Yeah, oh yeah. When I was a kid, I was in the doghouse. Then I went back to the penthouse when I made the NHL. And now I'm back in the doghouse. I'm in, you know, row 18 in level 300, right? I sent it to you. But hey, that's what I was willing to do. In the corner. Brutal sight lines. But guess what?
Yeah.
I was there to watch the Leafs lose 4-1 in Detroit on a random Thursday.
Yeah, I was going to say that, and you didn't get Austin Matthews, which had to hurt. How many? Was it just your boys, or were you there with the whole team?
No, so I was there with our entire academy. So we had, you know, all U7, U8, U9 players out in Detroit for a hockey tournament with the Clever Young Kings. And, yeah, we had probably 70 families at the game. So it was a lot of families. I asked Giordano, too. I'm like, hey, Gio, could you get all the kids down to say hi to the team? He's like, dude, it's the dad's trip. No chance. Yeah, so I was like, come on, bud. Can't you just get me some free tickets, too? Anything? Like, what can you do for me?
Yeah, nothing. Well, I was going to say that you're sitting up there, if you're with, you know, 70 people, it's a little more acceptable than...
Yeah, it's pretty acceptable on their part.
Yeah, that's okay. You guys are all doing a trip down to Detroit. I did actually want to ask you about Gio, just in terms of... So, he's leading the team in block shots, and I keep having this thing where I love the way that he plays, and I think he's just so incredibly important to their blue line. Like, he's more important than I think a 39-year-old should be for the Leafs, but you just can't deny it, right? Like, even when they show stuff behind the scenes in the room, like, if we're going to talk about who has stepped up physically when guys have been hit or when guys have had a moment, it's been him, right? There was one where he threw a spear early in the season, like a wrestler, when Matthews got involved with Konechny against the Flyers. There's been, like, Pontus Holmberg the other night, where he goes down, nobody sticks up for him. He's the only guy that shows up and at least does the skate in to make sure that his guy's okay. But with all the physical stuff, I keep going, man, please don't get hurt. He's playing a lot of minutes. He's logging 20. But everybody just keeps saying, oh, like, hey, but he's a mutant. But he's a mutant. But he's different. He's built different. He's going to be a horse. He's just going to keep playing. And, okay, I get that because that's very clear. He's 39 years old, and he doesn't look like he's slowing down. But was there anything, like, from knowing him and from playing with him that you would see behind the scenes that you would go, oh, okay, like, this is why you're different? Or this is leaving a lasting impression on me off the ice.
Yeah, he could squat 400 pounds the day before and go out and play a hockey game the next day. I was like, this dude is a freak. Like, I couldn't put the bar on my back, squat 10 times, and go out and play a hockey game the next day. My legs would be shredded, like, they'd be done. But this guy, like, so I'll give a little bit of an analogy about this guy and Jonathan Toews and great leaders. Like, my dad was always like, you know, Jonathan Toews and Mark Giordano, when you go to war, these are the guys on the front line running through the other. You know, the other war side, like, they're going front line, they're running through the wall, swords up, you know, head down, going through. That's Mark Giordano. And then my dad's like, well, you're probably in the back somewhere hoping, like, the first 7 or 8 rows get through, and then you're kind of stabbing someone, you know, from way in the back. So he's like,
you fought Willie Mitchell, all right? You should show your dad that tape.
Yeah, I should have showed him. But, hey, this is what when my dad would talk about Mark Giordano and leaders like that and Jonathan Toews, he goes, that's why these guys are loved, because they're willing to be the frontline guys, go into the battle each and every time. They're there for their teammates. They don't even think twice, right? A guy gets hit, Gio's in there. In the room, if a guy's not standing up for another guy, Gio will probably go tell him. He would tell me. If he doesn't like how you're playing, he's going to let you know, right? And it's nothing personal. And there's nothing personal. And he does come from a different era. And in that era, you told guys how you feel. And it is a little bit different now, but I think it is nice to have him in that room showing guys, hey, you need to be accountable for your game. If you're not sticking up for each other, not playing good, you need to tell him. And that's the era he comes from. And I think that is bleeding throughout this team.
I got to tell you that I've been thinking about this quite a bit recently, and it was probably coming off of the Bruins game. And I know this sounds like old man back in my day, this was better. I think that there's a lot of things that are better about the NHL now. And I know that you're a fan of the skill in the game that's coming in. Like, you don't like the fighting stuff as much. Like, there's a whole bunch that is trending way more in, I think, the direction that you love. And yeah, for me, similar thing for a lot of this different stuff. I don't really miss the show fighting, right? The fake stuff. But
yeah.
I did think it was notable, and I did start to feel a little nostalgic watching the Boston game on Saturday night, where it's like, it's Simmons and he's barking at guys and he's just like in on every single scrum. And then he does fight Foligno. And then when they're standing at center ice and the two teams are barking at each other at the intermission, that it's like Simmons that's allowing those guys to kind of stand there, that it's, you know, Giordano that's blocking big shots and just playing with a different level of intensity. And I don't know if it's a confirmation bias thing for me, where I notice the things that those guys do a little bit more, or that they know they have to impact the game that way. And so maybe some other guys age into that role. But I'm a little afraid of some of that stuff leaving the game, like the level of intensity, the level of care, the level of just, yeah, the amount of guys that just hockey was the everything. And that leadership component that you're talking about, knowing that there are going to be other guys that call each other out in the room, I've always worried about that with, the rest of the Leafs players, let's say, or a lot of the Leafs players, let's say.
It comes down to passion, right? You're always scared that the passion for the game is going to be gone. Here's what I kind of always tell people is, like, hitting someone in the head or show fighting isn't passion, right?
Yeah.
Trying to do something dirty to someone isn't bringing a level of intensity. That's just pure stupidity. That is stupid hockey, and it's putting people's lives at risk. There is a difference between passion and barking at guys and getting into the battle and pushing and face washing and, you know, just being in it, being in the moment. That stuff's way different than the garbage that used to happen when we played, right? And that stuff should have never happened. It was part of the game, and then it was allowed to stay in the game way too long, and I'm so happy it's not in the game anymore. The biggest thing the best teams all have is a level of passion that other teams aren't willing to get to. Maybe it's because of analytics. Maybe it's because of, you know, all this, these certain things that, you know, you bring in this analytic guy, and it's like, well, this line combo is better than this line combo with this guy. And I'm like, what happened to an eye test? Who's bringing the passion into the game? Who's out there barking at guys? Who's out there doing extra things that you can never even see on a data sheet, right? And that's the piece that, you're right, the worst teams don't have any passion. They have guys that don't play with it. They're robotic. They have no creativity. They have no jam. They're not willing to get into the battle. The best teams always do, and I believe the best teams always will, because you have to have it in order to play in a Stanley Cup playoffs. If you don't, you're going to get ousted. But again, I always talk with people like, oh, the game's good. I'm like, guys still, when it means the most, they play with passion, they're battling, they play with their hearts, everything, and it's still the best. I'm like, just because guys were getting kneed and hit in the head and punched and show fighting, that's never been passion. That's just danger, right? That's stupidity to me.
Yeah, I agree. I think a big part of the problem, too, though, is just the regular season setup for a team like Toronto. Like, I thought it was funny, because watching that Boston game, the other thing for me, too, was, and you saw it last night, which is they can match that Bruins level of intensity, and they can step up and like not really back down from it. And you see a lot more passion from the players, and guys step up with like their physicality and with those plays that you're talking about. But I also came away from it going, yeah, but Boston's also better at that. You know, that they're just connected, and it's top to bottom, where all of their dudes just have that little extra piece, and especially
no
from their front
right
end guys.
They're so good right now.
Yeah. But they play with that too. Like, there's a care level to what they're doing. And I keep thinking that, you know, I had Andrew Raycroft on last week, and I asked him about it, and I was like, yeah, is there a little bit of concern for peaking at the wrong time? I'm like, that's the only criticism that you can lobby at them is, hey, maybe they end up burning out. But it's like, what are you supposed to say? Hey, you guys care too much and you're winning too much right now. It's like, yeah, it's stupid. They're really a perfect team.
Yeah, and they're not taxing each other, I don't think, in the games. Like, again, they play against the Toronto Maple Leafs and these top clubs. They bring that level of intensity, but they're not. I don't find that their game is taxing a lot. I just find they manage the game really well. You know, you have a lot of guys that can break a game open at good times, and they have no holes, right? So they have four lines deep. They have four lines scoring. They have guys that score at important times, and they're not taxing certain guys. So you're right. Adversity could hit at a certain time where it bothers them. That, again, that's something that you could look at if you're going to look at a chink in the armor with them. But I don't know. Like, I don't find them being their game's not very taxing. They're very efficient at moving the puck. They can score off their rush. They can grind you down in the O zone. They can do many different things that's built for the playoffs. They're going to be a hard out. Again, it's just when it comes to it, yeah, if they lose two or three in a row, how do they handle it? I think it's fine because of the leadership in their room. But I just still don't find their game taxing or worrisome. Like the when I was watching the Devils play, I was like, yeah, they're flying and scoring a ton of goals, but they haven't really been punched in the face yet, you know. And they got punched in the face, they lost five in a row, and it's different. So I just don't see that with the Bruins, but again, who knows.
Yeah, they also have more cap space than the Leafs or the Lightning.
And yeah,
you know, I'm watching 32 Thoughts, or Elliot's on the panel, he's talking about potentially, you know, like the rumors have them at least connected to some pretty big names, and it's not outside the realm of possibility that they get on Bo Horvat. And you're like, that's not fair. Like, how is this? Everybody keeps saying, like, the cap is flat and it's ruined the league. And I go, yeah, I agree. This sucks. There should be a luxury tax, and you should have the good teams be able to be good, right? And you should be able to have them be special. And I think there's something that you're nailing with the analytics stuff in terms of, yeah, the type of player that gets valued and the thing that does get missed on certain spreadsheets. But yeah, then I'll look at it and go, well, wait, how can Boston add a Bo Horvat potentially? And then you remember that all their guys took way less, took huge haircuts on their deals, and you go, right, that's how it has to happen. Yeah it's massive. So the guy that hasn't been playing well has been Morgan Riley, and yeah, he takes a hit last night to make a nice play. That Dryden Hunt finishes, nice moment for him, but really it's been turnovers. It's been, yeah, a lot of focus on the things like he can't do without a lot of paying back the things that he can, which is like the skating and the playmaking. But it's been a lot of, oh yeah, you can't hold the blue line, your gap control is not great, you don't kill the cycle, and now you're turning the puck over. Ed Jovanovski was on Real Kipper and Born yesterday. He was talking about how, like, what his game needs to be is like simple, simple, simple. But how hard is that, do you think, for a guy like him that is leaning on always being able to make like big plays?
Yeah, it's just decision-making, right? And then if you're not making the right decision, your confidence goes and your game goes downhill really quick. And he's expected to be first-line power play. I know they have the five forwards out there at times, and then when they get scored against, they put him back. I still would like to see other guys there. We could get into that a whole other time. But when it comes to Morgan, he's coming off injury. TJ Brody's not there. And TJ Brody, again, when they're together, I think he's a real stabilizing factor and a stabilizing piece, because he's such an efficient puck mover that it doesn't have to be on Morgan to make those hard sauce passes or first passes out of the zone consistently. I know Liljegren can do it, and other guys who he plays with can do it, but not to the same effect and extent as TJ Brody can. So that piece, I think, hurts him. And then, yeah, he's coming off injury. You don't know if he's laboring or he's indecisive. But for me, a lot of things, too, that come with Morgan is just where he's making plays, and he's telegraphing plays way too many times. So on the power play, the puck comes up to him. He's not in a good spot on the blue line. He gets it. His feet are standing still. And you know he's passing it over to Marner, right, on the power play. But it's very telegraphed. So the whole PK moves over. And then he gets it back and he's standing still. He's not getting the puck where usually if he's getting the puck, he's getting it in motion and moving and creating shooting lanes and moving it around. He's never been an exceptional puck distributor, but he's really good at it because of his feet. And when his feet aren't moving with the puck, especially on the top of the blue line, when he's supposed to be portraying the top of the blue line on a power play, 5-on-5, quarterbacking the entire play back there, when he's not doing it with his feet, I don't think he's got the high enough skill with the puck in order to make those plays. So he's got to be moving with the puck, but that comes being confident. That comes, you know, going over some video here or there to be like, hey, here's where you are in the blue line. Here's where your feet should be moving. Here's what you should be doing in this situation. And then, but again, building from simple plays, because if you're going to try to do everything at once, you're going to lose your confidence and it's not going to come back really fast. But again, do it from simple plays, understand where you can get better and come from that, that stance. But again, I think TJ Brody's a big piece of that.
Yeah, Brody's huge, and they've obviously missed him these last couple of games, and it's probably been an under-discussed story how important he's been, because the Leafs have had so many injuries, and he was hurt for a while as they were turning their season around. But yeah, if you look at the numbers, just like the impact Brody has had on basically every single pairing this year, that like every guy that he's played with has gotten better. It's probably been an under-discussed story how important he's been, because the Leafs have had so many injuries, and he was hurt for a while as they were turning their season around. But yeah, if you look at the numbers, just like the impact Brody has had on basically every single pairing this year, that like every guy that he's played with has gotten better. Even when he's been with Morgan Rielly, it hasn't been great. Like Morgan Rielly has really, really struggled. And all that stuff that you're just talking about, Chris, like how much of it do you think is just like confidence with Rielly versus how much of this is you're going, oh my God, no, this is not going to be a simple fix, these things. Like, I know we're saying keep it simple, but all of it in kind of concert, it feels like, yeah, it feels like a little bit of a bigger deal. Is it or not?
Again, I think he's just got to start building on good games. I think yesterday there was good moments and tough moments at times, but you just got to keep building on games. He's got the ability to do it, and it comes back to moving his feet when he gets the puck and not relying on his brain and hands to have to do or to execute plays. I don't know if that makes exact sense, but if you're getting the puck on the blue line, when Morgan Rielly's good, again, I go back to it. He's moving his feet. He's dangerous creating shooting lanes because he's such an efficient skater. So those are things that the Leafs have to look at with him. Hey, start here in the O-zone, right? In the O-zone, get your feet moving, walk the line, create shooting lanes, and start to get confident making simple plays off blue line movement. And then if you can build from there, maybe you start to build it into the 5-on-5, or if you build it into the D-zone. I don't know what the first piece. You can't really boil the ocean, right? Is basically what I'm saying. So, like, what's the first piece that's bothering him the most that the Leafs have a problem with? Try to fix that first simple piece. And then you start to layer on the building blocks, right? I don't think you just go at everything. Hey, you're having a problem on the blue line. You have a problem in the D zone. Hey, your gap's not good. Hey, this, and that. Go at it really simple with Morgan. What's the first thing and the most important thing we can fix? And then start layering on the blocks after. And I think you'll be fine. But he's such a big pivotal piece to this team, and he needs a good D partner. He needs a guy that's got a good stick, who can efficiently move the puck, who can defend, who can let him hop up in the play as well. And that's why I come back to Brody. He's that guy. He's a veteran. He's a guy who's been through it a lot. And again, sometimes, yeah, he hasn't been great with him, but that could come back down to just confidence all around and maybe an injury.
Yeah, see, I think the confidence thing is big for Rielly, but that's the part I'm scared of, how it improves. Because to me, it's like, and, you know, I'm not in that room, and I'm certainly not in the film room, but watching every single game, if you just ask me, hey, what would you want Morgan Rielly to change? I'm like, well, I'm not expecting to become some cycle killer. And I've seen him in his entire career, like, he's not going to be elite gap control guy. He's not going to be overly physical, but what he is going to be is, yeah, someone who has to play with a ton of confidence offensively. And there are just way too many turnovers. And so you're saying you need to clean this up. Like, you can't have the pizza every night. You can't have the turnover that keeps ending up in the back of our net. And that is, like, happening routinely with him right now. Like, it's happening basically every single game, which is nuts, but it's true. Like, he is having a turnover that is costing them either a big play against or in the back of their net pretty much every night. And I don't know how you build, when we're talking about, like, hey, you got to build off of it, how that changes rapidly when all of your game is predicated on, yeah, making a play and breaking it out and sometimes making a riskier play for a bigger reward. So, yeah, like, I know he can do what he did last night, which is when he's got open ice, that he can fly down it and that he can see it well and that he can get the puck on and that he's tough and that he's unafraid. Like the play he made to Dryden Hunt, why I brought it up is that's the stuff I expect from Morgan Rielly. I think when we talk about things like confidence, and I don't mean you specifically, I mean all of us when we're discussing Morgan Rielly, I'm like, it sounds so much easier said than done, but I think that's easier said than done for guys that their whole game is just simple, is actually simple. His is a little bit more complicated, which probably makes it a lot tougher.
His is much more complicated, and he's expected to do much more. You could have exactly. Justin All is literally just expected to stick on puck, break up plays, go the other way. That's three things. Defend the front of the net, four, right? You got Morgan Rielly, who's got to do all that, plus run a power play, plus PK at times, plus, you know, he's got so much more to do, plus try to create offense off the rush, try to hop in the play, try to lead an attack. He's got so much on his plate, right? So that's where I'm saying you can't boil the ocean. What's the first thing that you could fix with him? If you're worried about pizzas in the D zone entries, well, get that, you know, where is he on the ice getting the puck consistently? Where's his head looking right when he gets the puck? Is he always looking for a cross ice saucer pass that might have high variability of getting picked off? What's his first option, right? Like, start to give him simple options that he can build on, that he can get his confidence. And then when he gets his confidence, he can start executing higher, harder plays. You come back, yeah, confidence is a funny word, but it is literally everything, especially for these guys like Morgan who have to carry the mail in every situation. You call them five-star D-men, right? There's only so many in the league. And again, I'm not saying Morgan is a five-star, right? He's not like the best of the best, but he's up there. He's a very, very good D-man. But he's got to do, in the term of five-star, he's got to do everything. Six on five against. You know, five on five, five on four, four on four. You know, he does everything. So he's got to play every situation, and that's just a lot of mail to carry.
Yeah. I have a tough time seeing how a lot of it turns around, which has me kind of worried. And yeah, Brody coming back, that's going to be
great. You could always think it could be the old January, February blues. I went through it often. Don't look at my plus minus during January and February, please.
All right, that's the first thing I'm doing after the show. So automatically, you're getting a screenshot sent to that. Last one from me. Lately during Leafs Talk, I've been writing down a lot of positive stuff about Liljegren. I actually had a similar thought to you. I didn't think power play one, but I expressed some frustration that he wasn't at least getting power play two over Connor Timmins. And I know that's what Timmins is kind of there to do, and you're trying to find him ice time, but... Yeah, I've really liked Liljegren lately. I think that he does a lot of really quality things. And yeah, I you haven't told me this, but I'm kind of gathering that maybe you do feel the same way.
He should be on power play one right now with guys up top. So you go with the five forward attack, right, on the power play. And I don't mind that thought process because you're going for it. I've played on power plays where we've done the five forward, and I've played the top. That quarterback guy at the top, it takes thousands of reps to understand how to walk the blue line, just like it takes thousands of reps how to walk the wall properly, where to be on the wall to get the puck, where is your foot position, stick position, everything. It's the same thing for that quarterback. So you can see when Marner's on the top, he's not efficiently moving across the top. When he gets it, yeah, he can start to create here and there with his feet, but it's just, it looks stagnant a bit because that quarterback, that guy at the top who's done thousands of reps, isn't there. That's generally Rielly's, and Rielly's not doing it efficiently enough right now with his feet. So I'm like, who else with their feet? You don't really need a big shot right now because you have Matthews, who you're going to rely on to shoot. Marner's the passer. You would like a guy who could shoot up there, so maybe even a Giordano, but who could walk that blue line to create more space for the wing or the wings on the flanks on the power play with their feet. So who's that guy? Well, Liljegren. He's super efficient on his feet. I watch him on PP2 on that one goal with Kerfoot. You know, he gets it, quick spin pass, right? Hits that flank guy. They go down, they get a shot, they score. And that's just one little look at it, but he could just be a puck distributor. He doesn't have to be a shot. He just needs to be that guy who creates good angles to get the puck to Marner and Matthews or Tavares and Nylander and get those guys with good pucks in good space just because of his feet and how efficient he is. That's why I was like thinking of it yesterday. I'm like, who's a guy that could do that, right? Like right now, Rielly's a little stagnant. It comes to him, stop, telegraph, pass. Who's that guy who would get it? They're in motion and they're creating it a lot from up top. And I'd like to see him there. And especially again, he's a righty. You could stack, Marner and Nylander in the corner, or he could stack Tavares and Matthews on the other side of the corner, and then you could have the three righties on the other side. So you're kind of getting one-time options and different passing options. So again, righty-lefty up top, you still have the two righty-lefties down low. But I think it could give you a little bit of a look too. But I think with his feet on the blue line, that's where it could change.
Man, it's interesting because, well, a couple things. One is just that even compounds the Riley toughness because he is trying to find his confidence, so you want him to be up on the power play, but they clearly want to see the five forwards. But then you also can't try out another defenseman because you're worried about knocking his confidence down even further. Plus, you just gave him over $7 million a season. It's kind of hard to say that a year later that he's off the power play. Like he's off your top
unit. Yeah, but again, like,
and that you want to take a look at the kid that you gave the short extension to.
Yeah, but like again, I don't mean to go back in time in history. You know, Duncan Keith, Brian Campbell, you know, sure. These are guys that when I played with, like if Duncan Keith wasn't going, he was off the first power play. He was back on the second, right? And then Brian Campbell goes and plays on the first. You know, you look at other teams that I've played with again, like Brent Seabrook, these guys, great, great power play D-men, Drew Doughty. If they weren't going just because of confidence, you go back to PP2, you find it, you can get a little more simple and then get back bumped up after. That's not to say Riley's not going to go back. I think you just got to put them on a power play where basically their power play isn't as fluid and as much movement as PP1, right? Like guys are moving around and you really have to be dialed in, especially if you're that top guy. PP2, it's just get it up top, flank, shot, go to the net, bang it in, right? Super simple. So maybe that could be a place for him right now, him and Gio, whoever it may be, that are just hammering away, taking shots, getting simplified, let him build his confidence and get him back there. It's not like you got to demote him from PP1. I don't think they should look at it like that. If you're going to win a Stanley Cup, you got to go with who's going. What did I say every time last year? They don't go always with the guys who are going. You're going to tick some guys off at times. If you're going to win a Stanley Cup, you're going to have to make hard calls and hard decisions. And you're going to have the guys that are willing to go through those hard calls and hard decisions. But I don't think he should look at it as that. It's just a place to get him his confidence.
Yeah, the problem is that they like never play power play too. They have one power play.
No, yeah, you're right. That is.
They throw Morgan Riley on the ice. It's like, hey, here's 20 seconds. Go back there and get it. And then
oftentimes
we'll have like, yeah, exactly. That's that. You basically get to skate a lap. That's you on the power play. By the way, you were a -29 in January, February in your career.
I told you. Not for that. Yeah, not good.
It's not as bad as I thought it was going to be honest. So good for you. -29. Way to go, buddy. The way, before you go, just tell us about Clever Super League that's coming up, how people can get involved, what it is.
Yeah, so Clever app, obviously the technology, it's a free app on the App Store. Mm-hmm. Clever Super League is a U7, U8, U9 competitive league that's been started in Ontario. And you could go on Instagram, direct message our commissioner, Jamie Stone, to apply and find out what teams are going to be involved. And yeah, thanks for having me on again, JD. It's always a pleasure with you.
Yeah, of course, buddy. Always have fun. +38 in every other regular season month, apparently.
So hold ya.
The splits are severe. They should have benched you January.
Yeah, my buddies and my brothers would always be like, they can't, like, don't even put equipment on in January and February. Like, you were horrendous right
That's
now.
That's insane. Minus 29 to +38 the rest of your career in the other months during the regular season.
Yeah.
Like, that is insane. I know, but I wasn't expecting it to be that severe.
Yeah. There's a lot of guys that have that, though. It's like mid-season, you're dragging a bit, confidence is shot. I'm just telling you my own personal. I'm not saying everyone goes through it, and that's why stars are stars. They can grind out those two or three down months. Where guys like me, it was like, you know, you're in the fetal position in the shower crying, right? Because you're -29 in 2 months. So there's cold water dripping. You're like, oh my gosh, I'm -30 now.
That's so good, man. Well, I hope that you're having a good January. You know, like, again, Clever app is killing it. You're busy. You're coming on here, giving great hits. Everything's fine. You got great family. You're doing all right, buddy? I'll pick you up. Yeah. I'll check in on you more often in January and February. Like, 100%, I'm checking in on you all the time.
Yeah.
I recommend other people do the same. All right, buddy. I'll talk to you later. Thanks for doing this. Christopher Stieg, 2-time Stanley Cup champion, and again, inventor of the Clever app, which you should absolutely go check out if you're involved in youth sports. Quick break, let's come back, and I have a pick that I'm going to give out on a Wednesday that I think is the most insane prop of the weekend. That's next.
Sports. Sportsnet 590. The Fan.
All right, it's time for action. Brought to you by DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. Download the DraftKings app to get in on the action. Must be 19 plus, and as always, please play responsibly. So, you know I love my Giants. Danny Dimes brought me in on the Giants. One is because, you know, he won me a lot of money on that Giants just straight money line bet at plus 130. Thank you, Danny. But I just like the way they play. I like their defense. I like Dexter Lawrence. I like Daboll. There's a whole, like, they've been irrelevant for a really long time. It's funny because if you're my age, you always think about the Giants and go, well, like, no, you should be fine. You won a couple Super Bowls and you beat Tom Brady and they were some of the most memorable ones of our life. And so you don't think about them as this kind of downtrodden franchise, but they really have been for a very long time. Those Super Bowls were a long, long-ass time ago. I am sorry to inform people, again, that are in their 30s. But the more that I've been prepping for these games, and the more that I've been thinking about it and analyzing these lines, because that's the point of the sketchy lines, right? That's why we do the Tuesday exercise of looking at what doesn't make sense. And I thought, man, that Giants line looks big. And I know that I already knew that they had gotten blown out by the Eagles earlier in the season. But I thought, this is playoffs and this is the third straight time thing and blah, 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 blah. Go on down the line. Different Giants team. They turned it around. They should be better. I'm feeling less and less confident about my G-men and about Danny Dimes. I'm actually not feeling so down on Danny Dimes, although I do kind of feel like, and this will probably come up in conversation a little bit, that we're not going to be so high on Daniel Jones going into free agency after this one, that this is going to be a bit of a different story than facing the Vikings. But if you look at defensively what the Giants do not do well, it is stop the run. And this has been a problem for them all year long, and it's something that when they got into a shootout against Kirk Cousins and they forced him into a lot of third down situations, it didn't feel as apparent in this game. But the Giants aren't the rushing team that the Eagles are. The Eagles are incredible at that, and it is the Achilles heel of the Giants. Giants have one of the worst teams in the NFL against the rush this season. Number one, as in worst. They were the team that gave up the most first downs on the ground out of anybody this year. So I like two bets. I like two props here. Number one, this is the safe one. Number one is I just like Jalen Hurts' rushing total, and I also like him to score a touchdown. Those are the safer ones. Those are like both minus 120, 115. Daboll was also Hurts' OC at Alabama when he was benched for Tua, and this is a huge playoff game where there's an immense rivalry between the two teams. I think Jalen Hurts is that guy. I think he steps up in these moments, and I really believe that he's going to murder them on the ground with his legs. Like, he knows what this Giants team is rushing. They're going to give him a lot of quarterback options, and I think that he's going to take a lot of those options to himself and end up scrambling for a bunch. So, yeah, his anytime TD is my favorite bet. But how about this? How about this? Boston Scott, all right? The other running back, the non-Miles Sanders running back. He scored a touchdown against the Giants in six of his last seven games against them. Let that sink in. Basically, every time Boston Scott laces him up against the New York Giants, he punches in a touchdown. That is just an incredible Giant killer number. Six touchdowns. I'm sorry, it's actually more than six touchdowns. I didn't write down actually what the specific number was, which is stupid when I was looking through his old game logs, because I was just looking and trying to, you know, stat track for some trends, and I'm going through it and thinking, trying to find value based off the rushing numbers. And every year I go back on Boston Scott, I'm like, there's no way that he just always scores touchdowns. He had one year where he didn't, but there was a game or two in there where he had multiple TDs. So it's more than seven and seven. But six out of his last seven games. So if you think a couple things. One, that he continues to just have this incredible tracker. It's plus 370 for any time touchdown score for Boston Scott. I just don't know how you don't play that. And I probably just put the hex on him. I probably just mushed it because I put it out there in the universe. But That's just a number that you can't deny for plus 370. I'm sorry, you just can't. Six touchdowns in seven games, you can't. And the Giants' rush defense, you put that in concert with the fact that this line is going to be 7.5, and maybe the Eagles get more players involved in their offense. I actually don't even mind a Boston Scott last touchdown score. Like, maybe this does become a bit of a blowout. I'm starting to get a little bit of blowouty vibes in this game. I don't know. It's just how I'm feeling, just in the gut. It's happened before, but there's just not a lot to support, and there's just a little bit too much heat for going the Giants' way after beating a Vikings team that we all agreed was fraudulent by a pretty low number. Either way, Jalen Hurts rushing totals, bing, you can put those up on the board. The revenge for Daboll, the leader in a divisional game, a week of a bye. I think he's going to be a little bit healthier. You remember that he's been dealing with some stuff. He probably runs it a little bit more against a team that can't really stop him. But then, yeah, from a value standpoint, plus 370, anytime TD for Boston Scott, a guy who scored six times in his last seven games against the Giants. That was Time for Action, presented by DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. Download the DraftKings app to get in the action. Must be 19 plus. Ontario only. Please play responsibly. Quick break. Come back. Talk to Sean Thornton. Just about everybody in the city is happy today. You know, nice comeback win for the Leafs. Not so much for our next guest. Sean Thornton, Chief Revenue Officer for the Florida Panthers, 700 games in the NHL, and founder of the Thornton Foundation, which you should absolutely go check out, thorntonfoundation.org. Good morning, Sean. Thanks for doing this, man.
Good morning. How are you guys?
I'm good, buddy. I'm good. So before we get into any of the hockey and a bunch of different things, I'm like, you know, prepping for this interview and looking up stuff. So you always want to get people's titles right, right? You know, within an organization, but like you got a real job with the Panthers. You don't have one of these like fake jobs that they hand certain guys who used to play, where it's like, yeah, you're kind of on the team this year. You show up in a luxury suite and shake a hand. Everyone's like, you got like a real one. You're going around. You're working with the corporate partners. You're in the community. Yeah. You're doing the real things. You just got promoted, big dog. Way to go.
Thank you. Yeah. No, I'm sitting down going over renewal pricing and tickets and suite pricing and partnership deals and, yeah, everything. You name it. I still go around to suites and shake hands, but the real work is done, on the 9-to-5.
Yeah. No, like, I didn't realize that you were such a smart guy. I was like, oh, Sean Thornton, that's a smart guy. Oh, who knew?
Just fooling a lot of people. Yeah, just fooling a lot of people.
Yeah,
it is tough to get past that perception. You know, you punch in the face for a living, people think you can't add 2 + 2, but it's not true.
Well, to be fair to those people that think that, like, think about all the guys you punched in the face. You think that more of them are adding 2 + 2 or less? Like, what do you think the numbers are? How does that break out?
I'm gonna just stick to the politically correct answer. I'm gonna stay right down the middle here.
Yeah, that's probably the right move to do. Hey, so honestly, though, I do want to talk a little bit about the role, because I'm fascinated by the idea of what you do in terms of trying to break into the market, right? Like the community relations piece of your job. And yeah, trying to get more corporate partners, working with your marketing teams, because it's just like, it's Florida, man. And like, this is not... I can't remember how many years ago this was. It was probably before your time there, where it was like... the league had to tell the Panthers, like, no giving away promotions at car washes because it's not fair to the season ticket holders. And it's like, yeah, it's a really tough place to buy in and a really tough place to, yeah, just make sure that there's consistency in the market. So, like, yeah, I'm pretty curious about just, like, what you do and how you do it and how involved it is.
Yeah, I mean, it started before I got here. I was still playing. I think the Violas have done an amazing job of when they – took over this team, really investing in the community and growth of the game. So, you know, we make a conscious effort through our grassroots marketing and community teams to put sticks in as many kids' hands as possible. We're in 500 schools with a floor hockey program. Between the three counties, we're putting, you know, around 500 to 600 kids through Learn to Play every single year, really growing the fan base at the grassroots level. And I mean, you see it. You're right. I mean, my first year here as a player, I remember looking in the stands and it was Ottawa on a Tuesday, and we had, I think, you know, 3,000 people in here, including wives and scouts. And, you know, 3 weeks ago, we were playing Arizona on a Tuesday and we were sold out. So we've really done a good job. Winning definitely helps too over the last few years, having a consistent team and having some excitement in the market. You know, this is a little different. It's more of an event town, right? There's lots of things to do in in Florida, whereas, you know, coming from Boston, that's a sports town. So creating a great experience from the time people get here to the time they go out the doors, and, you know, making a concerted effort to make sure that we're respecting people's ancillary dollars that they're spending with us.
Yeah, and you know what you do is you keep bringing Kodak back. Like, keep bringing Kodak back into the ring.
That definitely got us some eyeballs where we really haven't had them before. That definitely helped. Florida's been open for business for the last 2.5 years, and a lot of people are migrating to Florida. We got, you know, a lot of people moving here every day, and that's also helped on the partnership side and ticket sales side.
Yeah, no, absolutely it is. And I, all I could think of with you being in all those schools is, like, my mom hated floor hockey because I would just, like, rip all my jeans. I would just ruin them. And, like, but kids in Florida probably don't wear jeans to school. They're probably all in shorts. So the poor knees of the children. Like, you got to be prepping yourself for the class action that's going to be happening, you know, 20 years from now for all the kids that are like, Sean.
No complaints to the moms yet. No complaints to the moms yet. We do a good job. I mean, we buy all the equipment. We teach them the curriculum, teach them how to practice the stuff, and then leave it with them. So it's been a great program.
I love that, man. So one of the things that I want to talk to you about today is this is a weird thing with hockey is it's a sport of incredible trash talk. But it's also a sport where, like, you can't really mic up the guys, and we don't get that inside kind of access all the time, right? Fans don't really get it. You see it if you're up close at a game. It's awesome. You hear great stories from guys. But one of my favorite YouTube videos for trash talk is you. And it's like a bunch of mini broken up things that are, like, over the span of years. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. It's been sent to me a few times.
Okay.
The Bruins had this whole, you know, we were mic'd up a lot, and the CMO/PR guy for the Bruins was a friend of mine, so they mic'd me up a lot, and I had trust that they were going to cut most of the stuff that would have probably put me behind bars, as I was saying. So, you know, there's a lot of snippets that I think he pulled out, or somebody on the team pulled out and put them together and put them out there. So, yeah, I've seen it. There's all this stuff you'll never hear, hopefully.
No, but that's the thing. It's like, I think it's awesome. And I really believe, okay, this is a hobby horse of mine when it comes to hockey. Like, I bring this up a lot, but I don't think that the game does a good enough job encouraging personalities and showing that outwardly. Like, a lot of the stuff, even now, it's like, look at this guy. He wears a big hat going to the arena. I'm like, I don't care. Like, that's not personality to me. Like, sweet. The rich guys have nice clothes. Like, no, you could. Come on. You gotta be joshing me. Like, they all like fashion now. No, I like being able to see some of the inside look at the rink and the way that guys talk to each other, because it is so different, and I think that is really appealing to fans. And, like, that's why it sucks that we don't have the HBO 24/7s anymore, and that's because the Leafs ruined it, because they cut everything. HBO went that too, and the Leafs are like, yep, everything's got to go. We're a PR factory. We're not letting you put anything out there of consequence. There was, like, one interesting conversation, and it was through a door. That was, like, the number one thing. They were like, yeah, we're done with this. We're never doing this again. But yeah, I like, you said it, that you trusted your organization, that they were going to do right by you. And so maybe, like, it is a little bit more team stuff, but, like, yeah, you're a part of this, right? In terms of, like, trying to relate to a community. And, like, I am curious just if you have any thoughts on how the game can be better at actually, like, showcasing part of what makes this sport, like, to me anyway, special.
Yeah, I will tell you that the league level and the CMO level, there is a conscious effort to humanize the players and make them, you know, let people in onto what their personalities are. Now, I don't know if that always pushes through, but I know that everyone sees how it works in other areas. And, you know, hockey players are unique, right? They're, for the most part, fairly humble, team-first guys that don't want to be the center of attention, but at the same time have some of the best personalities you'll ever meet, because they're, you know, relatable. I guess relatable is probably the most endearing factor. So, and the camaraderie amongst them, and being able to capture, like you said, the chirping, but then I don't know if they do go for beers anymore, but, you know, you used to be able to chirp each other, fight each other, and go for a beer afterwards. And it was just all part of the game. So embracing that, that community definitely we think is important. Now, I'm not sure if it always gets, if the filters might get put on it a little bit too much. I don't disagree there, but yeah, I think, you know, you do have to humanize them to create that connection with the fan.
Yeah. It's just, it's like, it can be so exclusive, right? Because yeah, you've seen it as a player and it's there. Like that special community that hockey players have is so incredible and so fun. And if people can be a little bit more of a part of it, I really do think that it can help grow the game in a variety of different ways. Like I just even think about how much of the growth of the NBA has been, not just because the product, it's been because people know who the players are, right? Like they have just a bit 100%. More of an intimate connection with those guys and they're more open to it. And you're right, it's a far more individualistic sport, and so like guys are, you know, far more willing to put themselves out there and be an individual, whereas hockey, like, it is the collective and it's always about the team buy-in. And so it's just such a like impossible puzzle piece to try to break through. Like, how do you get those two things to, you know, that so clash with each other to operate in a way that you can get guys to better showcase themselves? Anyways, I think that you did a good job with it throughout your career. So two-parter, who was your favorite guy to chirp, and who do you think was the best at it? Other than you. You can't say you.
Oh, fair enough. It's a tough question on the spot. Brad Marchand's pretty good at chirping, I'm not going to lie. Still is, it seems like. Still gets other people under people's skins. Favorite person to chirp, probably Ryan Kesler, maybe?
Really? That's good, because he kind of works with us now, like sort of-ish, you know?
Yeah, okay. All right, yeah. The rivalry with Vancouver, and then, just moved on. You know, there's a few different chirps going back and forth there.
I love the Kesler one, though. This is really good. Like, I got to dig a little deeper into this one. Why? Because you thought, like, you could kind of get him rattled? Or because, like, he would give it back? Like, what was the reason why he was your favorite?
A bit of both. I mean, he could be a pretty impactful player, right, when he was on.
Yeah.
So knowing that he was passionate, he battled pretty hard. So if there's any way to get myself involved with him, I wasn't a very good player. So if he's focused on anything to do with me, that's a win for us in my mind.
Yeah. You played 700 games, all right? Like,
thanks. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Not a lot of guys played 700 games. You know, that's a pretty unique thing. Crap on it. I love that, too. It's like, you. So, yeah, Ryan Kesler can be good, and you can also be good, Sean. That can be fine. We can do that.
He was a better hockey player than me. How about that?
That's fair. We can do that. And there's a very small amount of people on the planet who are better at hockey than Ryan Kesler was. Last night is a pretty physical game, which is surprising for me to be watching, I'll be honest. Like, I watch every single Leafs game. I do a Leafs post-game show. And, yeah, they're not exactly the most physical team. They're not used to sticking up for one another. And I'm just curious, like, what you think that did for some guys. Like, you did that job a lot. Like, you did that job a lot where someone took a liberty or someone did a little too much and you kind of had to try to change the tone of a game. And, yeah, it's pretty clear that your teammates appreciated that. Like, now you're going to be a lifer involved in this league. You're well-liked. You're well-respected. But how big of an impact do you think that actually has on the game? Like, how many times do you feel like guys, it just completely changed your relationship with them when you did come to their aid, even if it was times where, like, obviously it didn't seem so obvious?
Yeah, I think the game is – for other people say this, so it's not my quote, but like, you know, it's 200 by 85 with no out of bounds, and the game intimidation is a part of life. So it's exponential when you're put in that situation with the best athletes in the world, and there's going to be emotions running high, and games are going to get chippy. And that's why I don't think, you know, fighting will ever fully be out of the game, to be completely honest, because it just, I don't know what the alternative is if there isn't a way to release that pressure cooker. As far as camaraderie, I think, not so much about the individual. Like, I had a job to do. It was, you know, well, no, I knew what my job was. It was to first and foremost protect my teammates. Secondly, protect myself. Third, change momentum if need be. And if I could find somebody to help me do that. But when you stick together as a team, you know, I remember being in situations after, I think it was an exhibition game against Columbus, and we had line brawls, and after a line brawl, and then you come in the locker room, and it's like, it was an exhibition game. You didn't need to do that, but you're doing it for each other. And, you know, you just want to be involved with people that are willing to put themselves on the line with you. So it definitely helps the team chemistry, I think. That being said, I didn't get to watch last night. I was actually out with a partner for dinner, so I missed it. But the I just know in general, when you stick together, it definitely translates off the ice.
Yeah, they did it twice. You don't have to watch. Leafs came back. They beat you guys. You lost.
Yeah, I did see the box score in my phone, yes.
Yeah, Leafs beating Tuesday, like beating a Panthers team on a Tuesday is like very rare as well. So it was like two things that I'm not really used to seeing. Okay, so yeah, you're really involved in charity, man. Like back in Boston, I know that like you're involved in the Dropkick Murphys charity, which is pretty cool. That's pretty cool. Like, you probably know those guys.
Yeah,
pretty
they're badass.
Good dudes. Yeah, I love Dropkick Murphys. That's pretty sweet. Probably been backstage a couple of times.
Me and Ken Casey are pretty close friends. So, and then one of his board members, Christine McMahon, is also on my board for my foundation as well. So, yeah, we're pretty tightly aligned.
That's pretty sweet. That's pretty sweet. Yeah, you do a lot of work with youth. I know you do a ton again in Florida, but yeah, tell us a little bit about the Thornton Foundation and yeah, how people can get involved, how they can do it, and what it's all about.
Yeah, so we're very fortunate. I had a platform as a player to create something. It started with my golf tournament, which supported Parkinson's research in lockout 2012. The Bruins were running my golf tournament for me and just passing the funds through to where I wanted them to go. Lockout came, weren't allowed to talk to anybody in the front office anymore. So I created my own foundation basically to keep that going. So currently it splits between pediatric cancer and Parkinson's 50-50. I'm very lucky. Everyone on my board volunteers. So every dollar that comes in goes right back out the door. Two causes, my grandmother had Parkinson's, and then as a player, I was, at pediatric hospitals quite frequently visiting kids, and you cannot, you can't help but be affected when you're doing that. So two causes that are very important. We run 2 to 3 events a year out of Boston. We have, a website. We can take donations. I'm very proud of the fact that, I've been out of Boston for, 9 years now. And the golf tournament still sells out. I still have marathon runners wanting to run for the foundation, for the cause, and people still supporting it. We have sandwich shops that are making donations from every sandwich made. It's just been great how people have been able to, contribute and really support it. So very lucky, very fortunate, and yeah, I'm proud of it.
Yeah, you should be, man. Again, people can go to ThorntonFoundation.org if they want to make a donation, which I always hope that, a couple listeners every time that somebody does come on with a charity, that we can at least get a couple of people that chip in some bucks. John, I appreciate the time today,
man. I appreciate
that. Yeah,
hey,
that's,
thank you.
That's great, man. Take care. Thanks for coming on, man.
You got it. Thanks.
Sean Thornton, Chief Revenue Officer for the Florida Panthers. Again, 700 games in the NHL. Even he couldn't help it, right? Like, it was just like... And I wasn't very good. It's like, don't need to undercut yourself. Don't need to do it. Ryan Kesler, though, that's good. Because I'll have to bring that up when we get Kesler on this podcast, which we 100% will. Yeah, it's funny because, Florida, that's pretty, I don't know. I haven't looked at their, attendance numbers in a little while. It's kind of fluctuates when teams have bad products and in more difficult markets. It's harder to get people butts in the seats. Florida obviously was amazing last year, so I'm sure there's a lot of carryover from last season's success. Plus, they can sell Tkachuk, who's an American-born player. That probably really helps them out. But, I just breaking into those markets and trying to make something that is sustainable does fascinate me. Because, listen, if we're going to have games, if we're going to have teams in these markets, which I've been not the biggest fan of, at least show me the signs of progress. At least show me some of the buy-in. I know that hockey is just, it's never going to be a major television product in the States. It's never going to rival the other ones. For a long time growing up in this country, you kind of look at it and go, well, hockey's compared to basketball. But we're the only country that does that. Sorry, I guess that there's some other places in Europe that prefer hockey to basketball. But even those are pretty few and far between. But yeah, you're going to have these markets, then I point to the Austin Matthewses and the Matthew Nyes in terms of at least growing some players. Yeah, you'd also like to see some commitment from the fan bases to be able to grow enough people that, you can routinely sell out a building. Selling out Arizona is an accomplishment, though. Even here, Coyotes coming to town. Should be like, whatever, I don't really care. I'm not going to that game. What was the last time? Leafs won 7-1. It was a touchdown game, I'm pretty sure. Might be mixing those up. No, they've been getting killed by Arizona. It was the Ducks that they scored the touchdown on. Yeah, actually, no, you got to go to the Arizona games because the Leafs need to win that. It's really important to them. Anyway, I hope that, again, at least one of our listeners today ends up going to Sean's website, ThorntonFoundation.org, and then, yeah, donates to pediatric cancer, good cause, and Parkinson's disease. We're going to take a quick break. I'm going to come back. And I have Amy Trask. I'm not surprised by the Chargers' decisions. The Sean Payton stuff is really heating up, but the weird thing with Payton is that it feels like he's been... He clearly has a bunch of different organizations that wanted him. I just feel like the Chargers, had they spent some cash, they could have been the front runner. And that'd be a really hard thing for me to reconcile with if I was a Chargers fan. And it's kind of the thing that you fear the most is, will our organization spend the money? Will our organization be aggressive enough when push comes to shove and we really need to make that big moment? We really need to have that, yeah, that time. And we can get Sean Payton with Justin Herbert. Like, I don't know how you pass up. If they know conclusively that he wouldn't have come there, despite the fact that, again, he lives in California right now. So it'd be pretty odd if he wasn't interested in coaching the team in L.A. with, deep-pocketed owners and a star quarterback. But I get sticking by your people. But, yeah, anyways, the theme of the discussion with Amy is going to be like, hey, if you're going to move off of something, then what are you pivoting to? But, yeah, if your option was pivoting to Sean Payton, like, I don't know. I feel like you kind of had to do that. That'd be pretty disappointing as a Chargers fan, as few of those as there might be. Not really sure. Like, if we're talking about breaking into markets with Sean Thornton, feel like we have to mention breaking into markets with two L.A. teams at the exact same time in a place where most people, yeah, love the Niners. And now we're kind of looking at these Sean Payton destinations, and I keep going. Even the guys in the group chat yesterday, like I think it was Pete that sent me, you know, it was Boffo who sent me the thing about the Cardinals being potentially out on Sean Payton now, or like Sean Payton being out on the Cardinals rather. I'm like, he was even considering that job? Kind of felt like he was going to be destined for something better, and now all of a sudden you're looking around saying, really, is it going to be Denver? I don't know. Either way, I'd be pretty pissed if I was a Chargers fan that only the offensive coordinator ended up getting the axe and our defensive coach, who just spotted a 27-point lead and blew it and ran the ball as infrequently as he did in that second half, was getting another opportunity at it. Anyways, the legendary former CEO of the Raiders, Amy Trask, that's next.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Okay, so quickly before Amy Trask, I did want to just quickly touch on the Provorov story from yesterday because I think it's a big one. I think it's an important one. So everybody's killing this guy, and I think fairly so, because to be so homophobic that you don't want to put on a pride jersey and skate around in a warm-up with your teammates is, I think it's pretty deplorable. Like, I don't think that that's a... I don't think that's a major leap. But I would say this, and I think that this is like a little lost in the conversation. It's like where we are right now, and this has been a while, but... And this is something where, like, in other leagues, I don't think that we've really dealt with this. I think there was a story with the with Tampa Bay Rays from a couple of years ago where there was one or two guys that didn't want to wear a hat or something that was for gay pride. But the one thing that I do think is a little lost in this is how far we've just kind of come as, yeah, just a society in terms of what is and what isn't acceptable. Like, yeah, we live in Toronto, and so it's very different. Like, we're very used to having pride nights. We're used to having parades. We're used to, like, you know, Church Street. It's very much like a part of, I think, life in Toronto is, it's a pretty openly gay city. It's not something that I think shocks anybody that lives here. But yeah, you're always going to have people from different cultures that view things differently, and you can't expect that everyone is going to have the same view as you. But I do think that it's pretty remarkable that, you know, in this striving for equality for things, that oftentimes we want everything to be perfect because we want to live in a utopia, which is great. We should strive for that. We should strive for universal acceptance of whatever people want to do with their sexuality. Again, like, it does not impact you. So it's hard for me to ever find something that doesn't impact a person, like actually aggravating a person or aggravating another. But lost a little bit in this is that, like, yeah, we do have pride nights across the leagues, and that it is such a big story when someone doesn't want to participate, and that you have one guy across the entire NHL that actually feels this way and doesn't want to do it. And tell somebody else, like, I mean, Provorov's the only guy. Anyway, so I think he deserves some heat from it, because he should. He should have to examine his views. He should have to examine exactly, like, why he feels this way or why his religion would ask for this, and because that's the way that they put it off as the Flyers organization. Tortorella kind of came out, and I've never seen Tortorella look less confident and more shaken at a microphone than he did last night, saying that the organization had a sheet. Anyway, I just think that, like, sometimes in the pursuit of perfection, we lose sight of progress. And I just think it's like, wow, look at how far we've come with so much of this from even when I was in high school. So yeah, pretty incredible. Made me, in a way, feel a little grateful today. Anyway, here's Amy Trask. Very pleased to be joined by the great Amy Trask, analyst for CBS, author of You Negotiate Like a Girl, and of course, former Rangers CEO. Hey, how's it going?
Very well, and thank you for having me. It's always a treat to join you.
Of course, of course, of course. Okay, so let's just start with this before we hit on some of these games. Is Tom Brady done? And follow up, if he's not, should he be done?
I don't know. And because I don't know, I don't know. Now, how's that for a perfect answer from someone who went to law school? Your Honor,
if he came to you.
Objection,
if he came to you.
I was going to tease you and say, Your Honor, objection assumes, calls for a hypothetical. Here's what I don't know, and I'm not trying to be cute with you. I don't believe he was best positioned to be as good as he could be this past season. I don't think he had the surrounding cast. I don't think the offense best positioned him to be his best. The question is, if he goes somewhere with better surrounding cast and where he's better positioned to be his best, could he be better? Yes, I do think he could be better than we saw this year. Could he be what we've come to expect? I don't know.
Thank God this isn't court and that I can deal in hypotheticals, because otherwise I wouldn't have a job. This is done. No one would hire me as a representative. That's not a thing. That's not things that something that's going to happen anytime soon.
Understood. And I just like to tease.
Yeah. So it's hard, right? Because I think that for a lot of us, we look at the situation Brady had in Tampa Bay and we go, okay, well, you had a future Hall of Fame receiver in Mike Evans. You had Chris Godwin, and your team wasn't healthy for the entire year. You had an offensive line that had some injuries on it throughout the course of the season, but came into the year where it was pretty well positioned. You got to pick your coach. You kind of built the scenario around you. And so, yeah, it did feel like exactly what you're saying, which is that the situation probably could be better. It's just hard when you look at the landscape of the NFL and say, okay, well, where does it make the most sense? Where is the situation for Tom Brady going to be better?
And, you know, I'm not sure I buy fully into the he got to pick his own coach. I understand that's a story that's been swirling since Arians stepped away. I understand there was friction there. You may be entirely right, and this is, you know, you may know. I'm just not sure that this was as clear-cut a case of that as we may have heard. As to where he goes, we all know Las Vegas has been rumored. We know his past with Josh in New England. It's a system with which he's very familiar. By the way, Florida and Nevada, both no state income tax. There's that similarity as well. And again, I'm being somewhat silly about that, but not entirely. He could end up there. I just don't know what he will be considered to have left by any team. But remember one other thing about Tom Brady. In addition to X's and O's and his value on the field, he has a lot of marketing value. Tom Brady can sell tickets. Tom Brady can sell merchandise for a team. So I think there will be teams that will factor that in as well.
Yeah, I would imagine that there's a lot of teams that want him. And I think that the state tax thing absolutely plays a factor for Tom Brady. This is a guy who applied and received PPP loans during the pandemic. I think that he cares about the taxes. I think that he deeply cares about the finances of this move. And yeah, the Raiders are an interesting one, though, because, and this is something that I was asking our guys today, like, are we sure that at age 46, he's all that much better of an option of than Derek Carr was? Do you feel...
Do you feel like,
for sure he is? Or, like, where do you think he compares to Carr right now?
Well, there's two separate issues in that regard, or three separate issues. There's his comparison to Carr with respect to what he can do on the field. There's his comparison to Carr with respect to what he can do in terms of leadership and assisting young players with development. And then there's the financial comparison. That was a very, very, very significant contract the Raiders had on the line with respect to Carr. I absolutely understand why they made a decision before any of that vested. So there's financial issues as well. There's cap issues. So I don't think, you know, on an X's to O basis, that's one analysis, but there are financial analyses and cap analyses and grooming younger player analyses. Could he be someone who could come in and really help Jared Stidham grow? Yeah, I think he could.
Yeah. Derek Carr carrying a cap hit of almost $35 million next year. I'm not sure how tradable he's going to be, but yeah, it's pretty clear that his tenure is done in Las Vegas after the way that, yeah, things ended. And I don't know if you saw it, Amy, but his brother was on NFL Network and he was pretty outspoken. And it's his brother, right? Like, I know how I would feel if my siblings, I didn't think were treated fairly, or basically even if they were treated fairly, but I was in a public position where I had to speak about them, like how I would react. But Do you think that the Raiders did justice by Carr benching him late in that season?
Well, I do understand why the organization made a decision to bench him for financial reasons, for cap reasons, for roster reasons. I do understand why the organization did that. I do not like the fact that Carr was not with the team for the final 2 weeks of the season. Now, I don't know if that was Carr's decision entirely and the team came out and said, all right, look, we'll have your back. We'll say it's our decision as well. I don't know if it was the team's decision. I don't know if it was a collaborative decision, but irrespective of whether that was something that Carr insisted upon or the team insisted upon or they agreed upon, I don't like that he wasn't with the team the last 2 weeks, even if he wasn't playing. Look what happened in Washington. Heinicke was seated and said, look, I don't like that I was benched, but I'm going to do everything I can to help Carson Wentz. Look what happened up in Indianapolis. Matt Ryan benched multiple times, each time said he wasn't happy about it, but he was going to do every single thing he could do to help the other quarterback succeed. That's what teammates do. So again, I'll be very clear. I don't know who initiated the idea that he wouldn't stay with the team, even though he wasn't playing those final 2 weeks. I don't know if they agreed upon it or it was sort of one idea and they sort of, you know, the team covered for Carr. I don't know. But I do know that I don't like that he wasn't there.
Yeah. Again, our lawyer, Amy Trask, I don't know. You got the deniability on all these things. Like, you've covered, you've done your due diligence. Like, we no one's going to get you now. Like, you have got it. But you could, I guess that goes the same with Lamar Jackson. Like, if you didn't like that Derek Carr wasn't there for regular season games, I would guess that the same extends to Lamar Jackson, despite an injury, that he wasn't there on the sideline for the Ravens.
Well, and again, different case in my view, because he was injured and it has come out since then that he may also have been ill. And if that's the case, I can understand the team not wanting him to travel on a plane with the whole team if he was ill. And I'm not suggesting it was COVID or any such thing, but if he was sick, and I don't know that that's the case, but that's what has come out, then I do understand why the team wouldn't want him on the plane. Had the team advanced, they would want everyone as healthy as can be. It is unusual to not have a leader on the sideline, I will say that, but I don't know the circumstances surrounding that. And I promise you, I'm not trying to be all lawyer with you. These are just my honest, sincere, strongly held views.
Yeah, no, I love it, of course, and I want those. I spoke to Jason Lacanfora last week. He feels pretty strongly that Lamar is going to end up departing, that ownership has seemingly made it clear with some of their actions and with some of the things that have happened behind closed doors that it's going to be really hard to come back to the table and end up getting something done with Lamar. And he's done some he was doing some cryptic things on Instagram, and it's weird. Like, this is 2023 where this is what we have to do, right? Everybody has to parse with what athletes do on their social media. Like last year with Kyler Murray, with the removal of just Cardinal stuff, and granted, like, they ended up getting something done. Money usually does fix these things. But if Lamar Jackson does become available, how many teams would you think should be in on him? How robust a market would there be for Lamar Jackson?
All right. See, I'm not going to be I'm not going lawyer on you at all on this. Yeah. The answer is a lot. He is a very, very unique talent. And look, if you are right, and I have the world of respect for Jason, and he would be well positioned to know such things, if Baltimore is looking to move in a different direction, I certainly hope they've done what I always say teams in instances like this must do. Ask themselves, and do what? In other words, if they want to move in a different direction, if they want to move on from Lamar, they better ask themselves, and do what? And if the answer to and do what isn't as good as the status quo or better than the status quo, then what are you doing? Lamar is very, very, very talented. And maybe they can move on in a direction that leaves them with an extremely talented quarterback. But they better ask that question, and do what, before they make that decision. If they do go in a direction, I think the line for Lamar should be very long.
Well, it's interesting with you because you worked with an owner who, has the saying, just win, baby. And it was very clear, you know, the prerogatives of the organization. And I am curious with stuff like this about other ownership groups and how personal it can get with some of these strong personalities where, of course, finances play a massive role in it, but like most of these people are just insanely successful, and dealing with them to try to tell them like, hey, okay, like the situation that you just presented, right, in regards to Lamar Jackson, that once it becomes personal, how difficult it can be for the rest of the people in the room, the rest of the people in the front office trying to communicate up to the top. That it is going to be just incredibly difficult to win without a player, or trying to get what you want against the wishes of an owner who might, again, this is all do the lawyer thing, I don't know, but maybe is being a bit prideful.
Well, thank you, co-counsel. I'm glad I've gotten you to do the lawyer thing. Look, there's 32 different clubs. The ownership of each is different, and the owner of each has a different method. Some owners give great, you know, authority and responsibility to their employees. Of course, ultimate authority and ultimate responsibility always rests with ownership, because even if they delegate it, they can yank it back at any time. Other owners are far, far more involved. So I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all answer, but I do know that I used to say throughout my years in the league working for Al, whenever I would hear fans saying, you know, Amy, you've got to fire the coach, or Amy, you've got, and when they say you, they mean the organization, because they know I wasn't doing such things, but, you know, fire the coach or cut the quarterback, I would always say, and do what? Because it just amazes me how many people will say, you have to do X, when they don't know what you then do if you do X. Now, if an organization asks itself, and do what? And the answer is, let's just do anything else. Well, okay, then maybe you have your answer, but you better go through that exercise.
Well, I'm just as culpable of anybody as doing those things. But it is kind of funny when you offer the expertise to say, well, shouldn't this person be fired? And then when you're asked who should replace them, you go, well, I don't have the expertise for that. Just the firing.
Right.
That part I'm absolutely qualified for. The rest of it, not so much. So, but let's follow with that. If you were consulting the Chargers, you're working with the Chargers right now, what would you be saying about bringing Brandon Staley back? Because, okay, let's remove the part that we just talked about in terms of who are we replacing him with? Because that's clearly a huge part of the conversation. There's finances that are tied up with this, all kinds of different, you know, secondary things that get tied to this. But do you think that when you have a loss, the way that the Chargers, like the type of loss the Chargers just experienced, that keeping the same people in the room and moving forward is something that most teams can overcome, or that it's something that most teams end up actually just crumbling because of later down the line?
Well, I think in large regard, you answered that question beautifully as you asked it. There are so many pieces that go into that, and that's an assessment that Dean Spanos and all the Spanoses and Jeannie Bonk will have to do. Do they believe that the team has the confidence in the coach to move past what was just a gut-wrenching, heartbreaking loss for that organization. They've already made some changes at offensive coordinator and I believe passing game coordinator. Do they think that's the answer? A number of players have spoken out on behalf of Staley, including the quarterback. I smile when that happens because really, what are the players going to say? Because if the coach ends up remaining, the player doesn't want to be out there not having his back. But I think the entire assessment has to be a very, very frank, direct conversation with the coach, and the ownership has to get the sense that they think he can move on and move up. There have been a lot of very, very questionable decisions. That was a gut-wrenching loss. But again, I think the world of the Spanoses and the way they run, you know, their businesses, they're smart, smart, good people. I would bet in making this analysis, they are asking themselves, and do what?
Yeah, it's just so strange because you always do this like with people, right? You go, well, how many chances are you supposed to give someone? And sports are such a different business because you'd like to think that, okay, something bad has happened. You want to be able to overcome that. You as a group would be bonded by it. But yeah, this is 2 years in a row for the Chargers. And granted, Herbert was young and they were a developing team the year before to just barely miss. But then to have those two things back to back, it's just, I think that there's got to be a part of this too where you're trying to appeal to a new fan base, right? You're really trying to bring people in the LA area. And how much does that weigh on a front office's mind when you're thinking about these decisions of, hey, like if this does go haywire, if this doesn't work out the following year and people blame us for keeping this head coach, what is our risk assessment from the standpoint of fans that we're going to turn off, especially in a competitive market like Los Angeles?
Great, great, great question. And again, the answer is different teams are going to assess that differently. And I'm not sure how the Chargers will assess that. That is a conversation I had a lot with Al, obviously not in the Brandon Staley situation because he never coached for us. But, you know, I had that conversation on a general level with Al any number of times. And the point I would make to him repeatedly is if you are going to make changes or not make changes that are going to have a negative impact on fan avidity and fan affinity and what we can do in terms of marketing and tickets and suites and advertising and sponsors, fair enough. You don't have to factor that into your analysis, but then you don't get to gripe if we have issues with marketing and tickets and suites and all of those issues. You're absolutely right. They are looking to make a mark in this market, and I say this market because I'm talking to you from Los Angeles, and all of these things factor in. I do think the Spanoses are very intellectually honest in the sense that they will factor this in or not to some extent or another, but they won't make a decision without recognizing that the issues you just raised will be impacted.
Do you think that like they have been making inroads like this? I know this is kind of
absolutely.
Yeah, you do, hey, because it's just hard to tell from the outside in terms of what the Chargers are becoming in that region. Because obviously, like the Rams, they win the Super Bowl. They famously have their games against the Niners where it's a complete takeover. They were worried about, you know, fan support at multiple different times in terms of the way that they're being received there. It's harder to kind of get a grip on the Chargers and how many people actually decided to stay with them from San Diego and whether or not one of these teams is actually becoming more popular in LA.
Well, I think they're two separate analyses because, as you noted, the Rams won the Super Bowl and, you know, nothing a team wants to do moving into or in the case of the Rams back to a market than have that sort of success early on. But you're right. Los Angeles is a very, very different market. Here the Rams win the Super Bowl, and yet they're still playing in front of crowds that have significant visiting team fan presence. I grew up in Los Angeles. Other than my years with the Raiders when Al moved the team to Oakland, this is where I've lived, and I'm familiar with that aspect of this market. The Charger fan base is growing in this market. I frequent the beach areas of town, and you see Charger gear all over the beach area. Does that mean it's not in other areas? No. I just like to stay at the beach, so that's where I see it. But there is a growing amount of Charger gear, Charger merchandise. I see it a lot, so it is increasing.
Yeah. I mean, the Chargers do have the more beach-friendly colors, let's be honest.
There you go.
Yeah, it definitely fits more of a beach vibe. Okay, so if we think Brandon Staley is back, which it appears more and more so that he is, that removes the most interesting Sean Payton destination for me. And I think he, like you, really wants to stay in Los Angeles. Like, that's where he's residing right now. I wonder how disappointed he might be that the Chargers are coming off the table in terms of a potential landing spot for him. So if we take the Chargers out of it, where, just for you personally, would be the most interesting destination for him?
Oh, wow. Well, you know, there's football considerations. Mm-hmm. Who has a quarterback I might like to work with? Who has team ownership with whom I feel good about working? What's the fan base like? What's the roster like? What's the environment like? But then there's personal issues. Where do I want to live? And people do factor that in. So, you know, I think Denver is a very, very intriguing opportunity for him. I would love to see what he can do with Russell Wilson. I don't think Russell Wilson was best positioned to be his best last season. Do we know if Russell can be the Russell we were used to seeing in Seattle? We don't know that. But we don't know that because he wasn't put in a position to succeed last season. I would love to see what Sean could do with Russell in Denver. But as I said, there's personal issues to consider as well. Does he want to be in that part of the country? What about family issues? Does he feel good with new Bronco ownership? They certainly have very, very deep pockets. Does he feel good about the roster? All of those things will be factors.
As a Seahawks fan who lives in fear of Russell Wilson ever winning another Super Bowl with someone else, I can say that I hope that doesn't end up being the case. That's dead last. That's dead last for me. Amy, again, it was so great having you back on. Thanks so much for making time today.
Absolutely. My pleasure to join you. And listen, you can co-counsel with me anytime. We'll just take it all on together.
Okay. I'll take you up with it. Enjoy the beach, Amy. Thank you. Do you know how
dumb? Thank you. Bye-bye.
Do you have any idea how dumb I would sound in a room with Amy Trask? Like, especially if we were talking about serious things, how horrific of a look that would be for me. I would clam up. People think that I can never shut up. I promise you, I would shut up in that situation. I would shut up so fast and hard in that situation. Not a peep. People would think I was a mute in that boardroom or whatever it is that she decides to have the co-counsel sitting next to. Anyway, fun show today. I got Timberwolves head coach. Did a interview with him already. They're going to run tomorrow. I'm very excited about it because, yeah, it was just a really great chat. He's an awesome guy, Chris Finch. Some of you that are hardcore Raptors fans will remember that he was here for a very short stint because he was Nick Nurse's rival who became his best friend and a guy that he competed with overseas and who got poached from the coaching staff really quickly. Caught up with him. Going to have Darcy Tucker on the program tomorrow. Really great stuff. Can't wait for it. It's been a minute since I talked to Tucker. Some of you are old enough to remember Tucker Tuesdays. Anyways, that's a wrap for me today. Do me a favor. Leave 5 stars on the podcast. Subscribe to the podcast. Share the podcast. Send the love. Follow on Twitter and Instagram @JD Bunkus. I'll see you tomorrow.